Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's 60 years after the landmark Supreme Court decision on segregation in Brown versus Board of Education, and when you add up the numbers, American schools remain largely segregated. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at Columbus City schools and hear from an expert on the trends of segregation. A new hour-long special by PBS Frontline on education, class, and race in America explores these issues in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
In Louisiana, some parents want to break away from the Baton Rouge School District.
These are some of the worst schools in the country. Nobody's getting educated in these schools.
And start their own.
It will be segregated along race lines and class lines.
The fight over education and desegregation.
We have an African-American president. They achieved their goal. Who can say we're not desegregated?
Separate and Unequal airs tonight on WOSU-TV. For more information, check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now by phone is the producer of Separate and Unequal, Mary Robertson. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
Part of the film focuses on a movement to separate part of Baton Rouge from the rest of the city and form a new school district. How does the Baton Rouge case exemplify the trends in the United States?
That's a great question. This film is about a controversy in Baton Rouge where a group of citizens dissatisfied with the quality of their local schools are trying to form their own city so that they may form their own district. Their opponents say their efforts will amount to a deepening of segregation along class lines and race lines. And the issue and conversation there seem to be particularly resonant and significant to us because of the 60th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, which of course just passed. And as well, of course, because Baton Rouge is home to one of the longest-running desegregation cases in the nation. And while Baton Rouge may have a somewhat distinguished history as regards these battles as regarding school integration, their battles were not entirely anomalous or unusual. And as we know, you know, these battles around desegregation played out around the South and in the Northeast, around the country, really, from Boston to Mississippi.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Mary Robertson. She's the producer of Separate and Unequal. It's a PBS Frontline special. It airs tonight on WOSU-TV. The issue of race didn't necessarily come up in so many words among the folks looking to split the district, but they were very open about economic factors, about complaining about why do we have to pay for this other part of the city that can't afford nice schools itself.
Yes, absolutely. The folks that are advocating for this new city believe that they need to take these efforts. They need to take these measures that some people characterize as extreme because the quality of the schools is just insufficient, is inadequate and poor, and that they haven't seen demonstrable change, even though this change has been promised. And they also see a faltering economy in their state, and they believe that a faltering education system is to blame. So they believe that by bolstering the schools in their communities, they can effectively bolster Baton Rouge, effectively bolster the state economy. They're looking, you know, they're making long-term projections, and they see this as a way to ultimately provide for their future. Of course, their opponents disagree that this is what's in Louisiana's best long-term interest.
Who are the factions? Who are the people that are pushing for this? Are they just everyday parents, everyday taxpayers?
That's a great question. The folks that are pushing for this are, you know, state senators, distinguished business leaders, and parents as well. So, you know, they cover a sort of range of demographics. There are those who, you know, believe that they have a vested interest in improving the state schools, the city schools, and believe that, you know, the economy and the schools have suffered.
They're not necessarily all white.
They're not necessarily all white, and they would be quick to point that out, although certainly their opponents characterize the movement as being largely white.
And the opponents aren't necessarily all black.
That is absolutely true. The opponents are not necessarily all black. There is a great deal of African-American leadership in the city, and the leadership, by and large, does not support this movement and sees this movement as jeopardizing hard-won progress.
When they're talking about the economics of this split, you could just substitute color of skin, and it sounds like they're having the same conversations they did 60 years ago.
Mm. And today, segregation by race is very strongly related to segregation by class and income. Certainly when we're speaking about our schools, racially segregated schools for all groups except whites are almost always schools with high concentrations of poverty. And this is something that we see playing out in Baton Rouge as well as across the country.
What do the opponents of the plan say will happen to the existing district if it's split apart?
The opponents of the plan say that essentially the sort of dire consequence of this split would be leaving those who need the most with the least, that you would be leaving a largely impoverished, largely minority community with inadequate resources to meet its growing needs. They say that this divide would essentially be creating a chasm, if you will, between islands of affluence and sort of wells of poverty.
You open the film with a look at one particular family. Each of the kids, it's an African American family, and each of the kids they're in junior high, and they're all going to different schools because they have a lot of choice right now.
They do, absolutely. We profile the Dangerfield family. We have a single mother, Nikki, who is raising four children on her own. She has three boys in the Baton Rouge middle schools. And as you mentioned, they do attend different schools. One is very into performing arts and goes to what is considered a very excellent middle school that specializes in the performing arts. Another is in a gifted and talented program at another school, and yet another is in a place where he can receive individualized attention and work in small classroom settings. So this mother believes that while the Baton Rouge school system is not without its flaws, that it does provide her children with a number of choices, and choices that would be diminished should this breakaway come to pass.
So has this been playing out in very many other cities across the country?
Yeah, absolutely. We were drawn to this story in part because of its complexity, no doubt, in part because we thought it was resonant in light of the 60th anniversary of Brown, and because these themes and ideas are so important to all of us as Americans. But as well because we noticed that there was a somewhat underreported trend of similar breakaway movements around the country, and they weren't just isolated to the South, although certainly it is prevalent in the South from Tennessee to Georgia, but it's also in Iowa City, it's in Malibu and Salt Lake City.
There's a sense about the South that a lot of whites just went into private schools to avoid segregation. Is that necessarily the case?
In the film, we do cover the white flight that many people see as a consequence of so-called forced busing. In Baton Rouge, so-called forced busing was instituted in 1981, and that date might come as a surprise to many. Of course, it's many years after Brown versus Board of Education,
right,
which was in 1954. But for decades, Baton Rouge resisted integration, and a federal judge stepped in 1981 and said, "I'm going to, quote-unquote, force your children to bus to achieve integration." And many white families did leave the school system in the wake of that forced busing. And, of course, that's a trend that we have seen across the country. Gary Orfield, an expert who's interviewed in the film, he's a co-director of the Civil Rights Project at UCLA, just came out with a recent study in which he says that since the Civil Rights era, our public schools have lost 30% of their white population.
So there's the segregation that we're familiar with that was struck down in Brown versus Board of Education, which was the legalization of segregation. Then there was the so-called de facto segregation that they tried to address in cities like Columbus through busing as well. In Baton Rouge, was it one or the other?
In Baton Rouge, there was de facto segregation,
uh-huh.
Absolutely. There was de facto segregation that existed until this forced busing, if you will, came in 1981. Forced busing lasted until 1996. And after 1996, the forced busing was replaced with more voluntary means of achieving integration. They created theme schools that were designed to provide incentives for people to cross neighborhood lines. And this worked very, very well, and it was effective enough to lead to the release of Baton Rouge from its desegregation order. But the entire process took some 47 years, which is really, really, of course, a fairly stunning number from the time when our courts ordered that our schools become integrated to when they actually became integrated. In Baton Rouge, that was 47 years.
And in the meantime, the school districts did what? Was there a period of improvement where the schools were doing well and people were satisfied with the education their kids were getting, and there's just been a recent downturn that's led to this effort to break away?
You know, it's a fascinating question, and to some account, to some degree, we have to rely upon personal accounts because the measure it's more difficult to measure the performance of schools before No Child Left Behind, which ushered in the age of accountability. So certainly, we rely upon memory, we rely upon nostalgia to some extent, and depending upon whom you ask, the school system in Baton Rouge was phenomenal in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s. The school district themselves would say that their performance has never really flagged and that they have suffered from what they would call a perception problem. They say that when white flight ensued, beginning around 1981, significant numbers, that that's when confidence in the school system was lost, and that while the school system has made steady improvements, that confidence has never really returned.
There was a principal of a high school that you interviewed for the program who became very emotional at the thought of his school being split up and seeing his students go away, because they would.
No, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think the stakes feel enormously high for individuals on both sides of this debate, because we are talking about children and we are talking about their education. And for parents, you know, parents only have one child or two child or three child, and you know, the stakes couldn't be higher when you're talking about what determines their future. And certainly when we're talking about a child's education, we're not just talking about, you know, their individual experiences, but we're talking about, you know, what will ultimately shape and determine the health and vitality of the economy.
Another part of the program is about a girl named Amarina. This is very, very different part of the story, different piece of the puzzle. She grew up in the Bronx and is attending an exclusive private school on the East Coast. Can you tell us a little bit about that part?
Sure, absolutely. This is a story that, you know, that matters deeply to all of us at Frontline. We've had the privilege of following Omarina and her twin brother, O'Marlin, for close to 4 years. We've made our first film with Omarina in 2012 when she was attending a Bronx middle school. And at that point, she had been identified as someone who needed extra support to ensure that she'd make her way to high school because she perhaps wasn't receiving all the care and attention that she needed outside of school. And she was, you know, she was identified because she was participating, her school was participating in this groundbreaking program that was initiated by Robert Balfans out of Johns Hopkins University. And Robert Balfans believes that he's found a way to identify potential high school dropouts in middle school. And there, what this means is that one can effectively target your interventions, that you can identify those most in need and deploy the interventions at a time when it stands to yield tremendous gains. So Omarina was identified and received the continuous nurturing and nagging of adults in her school. She had these so-called adult shepherds, and they made an enormous and determining impact on her life. And I don't want to give too much away, but she did end up, you know, she has ended up benefiting enormously from their care, from their love and consideration. And we also tell the story of her twin brother, and it's a bit of a sadder story. And again, I don't want to give too much away, and I would encourage everyone to watch.
But all right. Well, it's an interesting cap on the program tonight that'll be airing tonight. Mary Robertson, thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you so much, Ann.
Mary Robertson is a producer of Separate and Unequal. It's a PBS Frontline production which airs tonight on WOSU-TV. For more information, go to WOSU.org/allsides. We'll continue our conversation on segregation when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 60 years after the landmark Supreme Court decision on segregation in Brown versus Board of Education, and when you add up the numbers, American schools remain largely segregated. A new hour-long special by PBS Frontline on Education, Class, and Race in America explores these issues in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Separate and Unequal airs tonight on WOSU-TV. For more information, check the link at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now by phone from New York is ProPublica investigative reporter Nicole Hannah-Jones. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us by phone from Chicago is Greg Jacobs, author of Getting Around Brown, Desegregation, Development, and the Columbus Public Schools. Welcome back to the show, Greg.
Thanks for having me.
Nicole, you've written about how school officials across the country don't even know the status of their desegregation orders. What does that tell us about the issue of desegregation as an educational priority?
I think it's pretty clear that desegregation is largely dead, that where it happens and where it can happen, that's fine, but that there are very few communities that are actively pursuing it, even those that are mandated by the courts to do so.
In your article, you wrote about one school district in Mississippi that hadn't submitted required reports about its efforts in 30 years, and that is an order that is still in place. Why can't parents use those lapses to challenge school inequalities?
Well, I think the problem is when you have a court order that's been dormant for 30 years, and by dormant it means neither the Department of Justice, often the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, or the school districts or the courts have had any activity. A lot of times parents don't even know that their districts are under court order or that they have any rights to challenge what the district is doing. A lot of times school districts couldn't even produce the desegregation order. Even school officials didn't know what they were supposed to be doing.
Even the Justice Department.
Yes, in some cases, the Justice Department's list of districts that were under court order had errors. Just overall, what you're finding is that these many orders have been allowed to lapse for so long that no one involved really knows what's going on.
Greg, we heard earlier about the efforts to reshape the school district in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to reflect the economic and, I guess, de facto racial divide in that city. You've written that desegregation failed in Columbus because it was incompatible with the shape of the city's geographic and economic growth. Can you go into a little bit more detail about that? How so?
I think Nicole is absolutely right in her focus in a lot of her work on segregated housing. Because I think one of the issues with school desegregation, and I think one of the reasons why people aren't turning to it as a tool right now, is that it's very hard to overcome, you know, a century of segregated housing patterns. And I think in Columbus in particular, you know, what happened was the peculiar annexation policies of the city allowed a huge chunk of the city to remain in the city but not be in the Columbus public schools. And so what you saw was by the time of school desegregation, something like 40% of the city was being served by suburban schools. And that became sort of a safety valve for developers that allowed the city to keep growing, but, you know, didn't quite abandon the city schools, but certainly kind of left them hanging.
Many people have said that desegregation was doomed from the beginning. In your book, you challenge that belief as it applied to Columbus. You don't think it was necessarily doomed. Why?
Well, I mean, I think Columbus had a lot going for it, and, you know, just the nature and the history of the city. Columbus has always been sort of a moderate place. So a lot of the really extreme racial tensions that plagued cities in the 60s and 70s didn't quite reach that point in Columbus. And, you know, there's an interested civic leadership. There was a degree of racial balance and a geographic capacity to integrate that made it plausible that, you know, if it could work anywhere, it could work here. And I think, you know, Columbus did put a real effort into it, I think. But I think ultimately, because of the patterns of housing and because of the nature of segregated living in the city, I think it just, the resources sort of drained slowly from the city or from the city schools. And I think that has made it much, much more difficult for the schools to sustain the kind of quality that's needed.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, you wrote about Tuscaloosa, a school district in Tuscaloosa, last April. And it was pretty shocking after a federal court released Tuscaloosa City Schools from a desegregation mandate. Things changed a lot.
Yeah, what I wanted to do was really show that a lot of the resegregation that we see is intentional. I think we kind of tend to look at these issues as being benign or it's just a factor of where people live. But a lot of times school officials are making very intentional decisions that lead to segregation and resegregation, and that's what happened in Tuscaloosa. Immediately after being released from its court order, school officials voted in a racially divided vote to split apart the single integrated citywide high school and create three new high schools, one which opened entirely black and which had a feeder system of elementary and middle schools that were also entirely black. And that's the system that remains there today.
I've been to lots of meetings with parents from the Columbus City schools and the Central City that complain that they want their kids to go to a neighborhood school, too. They don't want to bus their kids either.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that I think that's been a tension that has existed within the city schools since really even the 1800s. Mm-hmm. This question of whether or not, especially for African-American families, do you want integration because the sense is that the resources follow the white families, or do you feel like if you go into that realm, then essentially you will be neglected and the students will be tracked. You'll have all kinds of other problems that accompany the kind of racial isolation that you'll have. And I think that is a real rift. And I think it's one of the reasons why school desegregation isn't really turned to anymore, because I think as a tool, school desegregation forces you to choose one side or the other. And I'm not sure that parents are willing to do that.
Hmm. Nicole?
Well, I guess what I'd say are two things. I think that we need to understand that what school desegregation was trying to do was undo racial caste, and that was never going to be easy. There was never going to be a solution that everyone agreed with and that didn't seem like it was harmful to some students. I think, obviously, most parents want a school that's close to home for lots of reasons. But parents are willing, white and black, to bus children if it means that their kids are going to get a substantially better educational opportunity. And what we do know is that these racially segregated schools that serve almost entirely black and brown populations, those kids are still getting an inferior education. We have not managed to make separate but equal come true yet. We've never managed to do that. We didn't do it before Brown, and we haven't done it now.
Greg Jacobs, Columbus City Schools are mired in controversy now because of manipulation of attendance records and that sort of thing. What is the effect of the mandatory testing had on school districts across the country? I talked earlier with Mary Robertson, the producer of Separate and Unequal, which airs on PBS tonight, about that, and that it did start to show up the school district more for what it was once it was measured.
I think there's probably some truth to that, but I think there's also, something that Nicole says in her piece about Tuscaloosa is, none of this is an accident. And I think there's a tendency to want to believe that all of the policies that were put in place over a century to separate blacks from whites in the schools and then in de facto ways to move away from blacks in the central city, that those still have a ripple effect, that we're still feeling those. There's no sort of moment in time where we can say the impact of that has stopped and now we're at a neutral point and let's move on. So I think, to blame the city schools for the fact that resources have been draining from them for decades and is then seen in low test scores or whatever, is, I think, only identifying a part of the problem.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, the districts that are grappling with these problems now, what are they saying about it? Often we hear things from the outside, what the parents are saying about it, what groups are saying about it. What are the districts saying about it? What do they want to do?
Well, I think it depends on the school district.
Okay.
What we know is that there are school districts, and largely because of the communities that they're in, who are still determined to have racially balanced schools because they understand what it means for achievement. Of all the things you can do for achievement, integration is one of the top things because it ensures equal resources. So you have, I made sure that I pointed out Louisville, Kentucky, as a place where even after it came out from under its desegregation order, even after the Supreme Court struck down its voluntary desegregation plan, it has continued busing and other efforts, magnet schools, to try to keep the schools racially balanced and ensure opportunities. So you have that. But then you have on the other spectrum districts that have completely given up, that don't take race or socioeconomics into account at all, that are promising separate but equal and not delivering that. And I think those are cases that we're seeing a lot more. And then you have districts where there are no white students to integrate in other schools. And that's often what you find in the Midwest and the Northeast are city centers, city school districts that are almost completely black and brown, surrounded by suburban white school districts. And there's very little that can be done to integrate those schools.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Nicole Hannah-Jones of ProPublica and also Greg Jacobs. He's the author of the book Getting Around Brown, Desegregation, Development, and the Columbus Public Schools. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Nicole, what are the benefits on both sides of the coin? There's an intrinsic value, even if you're going to a school that's desegregated or that's diverse. If you're the kid that's coming from the wrong side of the tracks, we often talk about the benefits that way, but there's benefits on both sides, right?
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that's important to note is that decades of studies have shown that integrated classrooms do not hurt white students. That's often what you hear is parents who say that they're not opposed to the idea of integration, but they feel like that's going to bring down the educational opportunities of their children. And that's just not true. Integrated classrooms actually benefit white children. What they have shown is that in classes like math, having these diverse perspectives actually pushes the thought process. And so you see kids who are able to do more inquiry and learning. You don't see lower test scores. And I think it's important to understand that people who grow up in different environments have a value, and that it's not only that black and brown children will benefit from being next to white children, but that it is a mutual benefit in many ways. And I think we also need to stop looking at the benefits of integration as only being around how well someone scores on a test. There are very long-term benefits for both white and black children to integration, meaning more likely to work in an integrated workplace, to go on and live in integrated communities, and to send your own children to integrated schools, which, of course, in our increasingly diverse society is very important. So it's not just about a test score, but really the lifelong benefits for our entire community.
Tease in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I worked for Columbus Schools as a data analyst for 28 years, and I just, one of my primary jobs was just collecting information about the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And it just from my viewpoint of just looking at trends, it looked like once court mandated desegregation was lifted, that the parents and the students voluntarily resegregated the schools.
How so?
By choosing where they go.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I've got most of the schools now in Columbus are either mostly, I would say, 75% plus black and 25% plus or negative other races.
Mm-hmm.
And except for a few schools that run the other way, they're 50 or 60% white, and the rest is a mix of, you know, Hispanic, Asian, and black.
Greg Jacobs.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things that makes Columbus, you know, really stand out is that in the wake of the lifting of the school desegregation order, I think in 86, what happened was an enormous amount of housing was built in the areas of the city that were not in the Columbus School District. So unlike other cities in the Midwest, you didn't see, you know, what could be characterized as white flight from Columbus. People didn't abandon the district or the city in droves. What they did was the new people who were coming into the district moved into those areas that were served by suburban schools and not by the city schools. So it wasn't so much that it was a decision to self-segregate. It was more that the new folks that were coming in, moving into the city, were settling in the areas served by the suburban school districts. And that slowly began to tip the racial balance toward majority black over time.
And if I could, now, I don't know Columbus in particular, but what he's speaking of is very common. And what I was able to show, this same thing that happened in Tuscaloosa, all of the development started to go in the area of the town that would it was already heavily white and that was going to kind of funnel into the only schools in the Tuscaloosa City Schools that were majority white. These are intentional decisions, though, and I think to call it self-segregation makes it seem as if everyone has the same choice and that certain parents are somehow choosing low-performing, high-poverty schools for their kids and other parents are choosing high-performing. I think every parent would choose a high-performing school if they could. But development decisions, the decision to put development into specific school districts and specific school attendance zones, these are all intentional, and they're designed to allow middle-class parents access to the best schools in a community.
And I think you might even see that there's a growing black middle class in Columbus. And you started to see that in some of the suburban areas as well, and that complicates things a tiny bit, too, that they're moving to where they perceive the best schools to be as well.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That jumbles exactly up the racial picture.
It is, and what you then get are black schools that are almost entirely poor, where before you had black schools that were more mixed income.
Yeah. There's a kind of a legendary school in Columbus from the 50s called Champion Junior High.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, it was the prestige black school because nobody could teach anywhere else, black PhDs and master's students and, black professionals of the time. So it was this great school with this great staff. And, one of the consequences of desegregation was it allowed all those people to scatter and, go more places, which was a great freedom and liberation and absolutely necessary, but had this unintended consequence of dispersing what was a very concentrated and powerful middle class.
That brings up an interesting point about funding for educators and what the districts are able to spend, and there's a big difference in that, Nicole Hannah-Jones.
I
think it's interesting what he just said about that they could move on too.
Well, absolutely. I mean, part of being an American is being able to choose certain things and hopefully buy access into certain things. The problem is that when you have public schools, we're not talking about people who are paying money for private schools. We're talking about public schools where some are vastly superior and some are vastly inferior within a same system. And I think that's what the problem is. So, of course, integration has meant that black Americans who have more money are able to move into better school districts, but we still have the same children who are being left behind. I don't know that funding in general is the issue, and a lot of within districts, I think it's an issue across districts. But what I have found is that a lot of times city schools, high poverty schools, are getting a little bit more funding because they're getting federal dollars for serving high poverty kids. Funding isn't necessarily the problem within a district.
Okay, Nicole Hannah-Jones, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Nicole Hannah-Jones is a ProPublica investigative reporter. We'll have some links to her articles on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And Greg Jacobs, thanks as well to you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Greg Jacobs is the author of Getting Around Brown, Desegregation, Development, and the Columbus Public Schools. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 60 years after the landmark Supreme Court decision on segregation in Brown versus Board of Education, and American schools remain largely segregated. A new hour-long special by PBS Frontline on education, class, and race in America explores these issues in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Separate and Unequal airs tonight on WOSU-TV. For more information, check the link at WOSU.org/allsides. Still with us is joining us now by phone is Penn State professor and co-author of the report Brown at 60, Great Progress, A Long Retreat, and An Uncertain Future, Erica Frankenberg. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
In a summary of your report, you said that Brown versus Board of Education set in motion large changes and political conflicts that continue today. What have been the overall benefits?
Sure. Well, we've seen, particularly in the South and for African American students, which is really what Brown was initially most closely targeted to, there was tremendous gain in terms of their enrollment in majority white schools. So there was actually little change for the first decade after Brown, which a lot of people aren't aware of. But starting in the mid-1960s, there's a dramatic increase in the percentage of black students attending majority white schools in the South. And so by the late 80s, over 40% of black students were in these majority white schools. And in the South, actually, by 1970, was the most integrated region of the country, which, as a native of the region, I like to point out. Since the 1980s and 1990s, we've seen a steady decline, in fact, a fairly rapid decline in the South. Black students are still the most integrated than any other region of the country in the South, but we're seeing very shocking levels of return. In fact, black students in 2011, we found, were more segregated than they had been since 1968, which is before a lot of the landmark civil rights legislation and cases from the Supreme Court came down. So we're seeing still a legacy of improvement from Brown, but a lot of that improvement has been receding in the past few decades.
What do we know? I mean, back in the 1970s, when the South was the most integrated region of the country, was anybody measuring whether or not the integration was good? I mean, not in and of itself, but that it was a successful educational experience for everyone.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's one of the ways in which we say today that we know a lot more than we did at the time of Brown. We've had 60 years of experience to document one of the fundamental premises of Brown, that segregation was inherently unequal. So we know, for example, that there are fewer resources that are really important for educational opportunities in schools that educate majorities of Black and Latino students. These schools traditionally have high concentrations of low-income students. They have trouble attracting and retaining qualified teachers. They don't have as many AP courses, many of the basic things that we know are important for students learning. But there's this newer line of research that we're beginning to learn about that I think has been less understood, that integrated schools benefit students of all races. And this wasn't a part of Brown, but has been part of the more recent arguments around school integration, that, you know, as a white student, I benefited from attending an integrated school, and that we should want all of our students who are going to be living and working in a diverse workplace and country and even, you know, a global economy, we need them to be attending diverse schools to reap the benefits that they can only get in diverse integrated schools.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm speaking with Erica Frankenberg. She's a Penn State professor and co-author of the report Brown at 60, Great Progress, A Long Retreat, and An Uncertain Future. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Sandra in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sandra.
Oh, yes. Hi. So this is such a great program. I'm very grateful to you for it. I have a question about the sort of tension between a desire for diversity and integration, which I very much have for my children, which is why they're in this Columbus City Schools system, and the need for all children have access to a strong neighborhood public school, which might in fact produce a kind of de facto segregation or resegregation in its wake. It's a problem I just don't know how to resolve, but it seems to me that it's really only parents who are paying attention under the current system to, you know, get their kids into magnet schools or, lottery schools who are getting the benefits from integration. And what do you do with the children who are left behind in their neighborhood school that's faltering?
Sure, you bring up lots of really great questions that are sort of the landscape of desegregation right now across the country, as we've seen school choice rising, and at the same time knowing that we have declining levels of neighborhood segregation, but they're still fairly segregated. There is this inherent tension. If we're going to use choice to create diverse schools like magnet schools, then that's going to be really beneficial for the students who attend them, assuming that those schools don't then resegregate within them, which is a whole another issue for another time. But we do have to really think about how to balance the needs of those few good schools versus the entire district. One of the strategies that I find to be really promising that's being used in a number of districts is to have what's called a controlled choice plan that goes across the entire district. So in essence, people submit their choices and they can consider all schools in the district. And then the district considers those preferences along with thinking about how it would affect diversity in assigning students. So that allows the district to have a say in terms of meeting its goals of diversity, and parents can also have a say, and schools can work to develop different unique themes, for example. This, I think, is promising to get at some of the issues you raise. That way it doesn't have some have schools and some have not schools, and it helps to at least break some of the very strong linkages that still exist between neighborhood segregation and then segregated schools if we see a neighborhood schools pattern. In districts that have implemented these plans, there are very high percentages of parents who are putting out of neighborhood schools as their first choice. So it suggests to me that if done right, parents don't necessarily want a neighborhood school. They just want the school that's right for their kid. Of course, that involves a lot of education on the part of the district, providing transportation, things like that to make sure that choice is equitable. But I think that's a promising strategy given where we are right now in terms of neighborhood segregation.
Thanks a lot, Sandra, for that call. Fred in Columbus, you're on the air with Erica Frankenberg of Penn State. Hi, Fred.
Hi. So it seems like to me the root of the problem is where you live, your house or your apartment, determines or limits your school choices. Why is that? I thought I'd read somewhere, and you can tell me if you've ever heard of this, in Ohio, every parent has a guarantee they can send their kid to any school they can get their kid to, regardless of whether they're in their district. Now, I read that once, and I've never heard anybody talk about it. But when people talk about school choice, do they really mean choice, or do they just mean choice within your district? And it seems to me that if a kid from Westerville can come to a great school in Columbus, or a kid from the Hilltop can go to a great school in Hilliard, why not?
Yeah, I think you raised some good questions. My assumption, I don't know Ohio law very clearly, but my assumption actually based on a fairly publicized case a few years ago out of Akron, a woman had enrolled her child in the district next to Akron where I think her grandparents lived.
Right.
And the woman was jailed for sending her child to that district because she didn't live there.
Under false pretenses, right.
Exactly. So my assumption is that Ohio law does not permit you, and most states, unless they have a sort of inter-district choice program, don't. But I think that you raised some really important questions that we have to start thinking about more of. One of the things that we know from research is that most segregation exists between districts, particularly in places like the Midwest, where you have these balkanized metropolitan areas. You have a central city district and that may be heavily minority, and you have white suburban districts that are separate districts, so you're not assigning those kids to the same schools. You know, we think of a lot of different parts of governmental services today in regional metropolitan area ways. And I think we have to start thinking about that in schools. We do so in some areas, some parts of the South and the West think of schools on a countywide basis. And that gives us totally different options in terms of assigning students to schools. But right, if we really do want choice, and school districts are actually just arms of the state government to carry out the purpose of providing education. So it seems to me that if we really wanted to get at these issues of segregation and opportunity for students, we would think about school district boundaries as not being as rigid as they have historically been.
In Ohio, school districts are still largely funded by property taxes, though. That's that always been a sticking point in Ohio.
Right. Well, you know, there's this one really interesting model that I'll mention in Omaha, Nebraska, in which they've created this learning community of 14 different districts to start pulling both tax bases and also student assignment. And it's really a novel, certainly the first of its kind that I know of on such a wide-scale basis. We do have such a rooted sense of local control in education, and that's why historically schools are tied to the community, and that's why there's funding and funding inequities as well. But certainly that's the root of the issue, and so regionalizing has always been resisted because of this sense of local control.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as we continue to grow more interconnected, we have to think of our schools more interconnected as well. Although, you know, certainly everyone has attachment to a neighborhood school. So I'm not saying that it's politically going to be the easiest thing to do.
And another issue that Fred brought up was, well, you know, if I can get my kid to Westerville from the Hilltop, which is on the other side of Columbus, why shouldn't I be able to? The laws notwithstanding, transportation is a big issue for a lot of people anyway. It is a huge expense for school districts now. Mm-hmm. It's a very practical concern.
Absolutely. And, you know, we also have things like really bad winters, for example, and in the north, or some places have hills or rivers. You know, there are lots of practical geographic concerns that involve transportation. And you know, one of the real challenges we've seen in recent years for integration is that the Great Recession really has caused a number of school districts to cut back their transportation. At the same time, we know, of course, there are a number of increasing number of two-parent households that are working that makes it difficult for those parents to get their kids to schools. And this is particularly more challenging in places that don't have a very strong public transportation infrastructure. So absolutely, the transportation, I think, is a very challenging thing. I will say one thing that makes me think that we could possibly improve on what we have been doing is just the technological advances. If we can get GIS mapping, for example, into our bus transportation system to make sure that we're using the most efficient, effective routes, perhaps that can help us to use the money that we do have to spend on transportation more wisely. But right, if we're offering the chance for students to go to a school and they're not being provided with transportation, I question whether that's actually a real choice that we're offering them. In some ways, it's just this illusory notion that they're not actually able to take advantage of, and that doesn't really seem to be doing any meaningful good to me.
Fred, thanks a lot for that call. We often think of segregation, desegregation in terms of black and white. And you make the point in the report that Latinos are the most segregated population now in suburban America, at least. What does that tell us going forward?
Yeah, I think we really need to think about school segregation in a much different way than sort of the black-white notion of the 20th century. We need to certainly think about it in a multiracial way. Latinos are, for example, even in the South, which is historically the place in which we've had the most black students, Latinos outnumber black students. So even in that region, it's a multiracial issue. The Midwest has the lowest percentage of Latinos, but in all regions of the country, Latinos are growing. And so we need to really think about how we educate multiple groups. Latinos as well as blacks have historically had the lowest educational attainment. So making sure that if we just put Black and Latino students, for example, in a school and call that desegregation, we're probably not going to really be offering those students high-quality educational opportunities. So we have to first think about it in a multiracial way. But second, we also need to think about it in our suburban areas, and that's been one of the focuses of some of my work lately, because we see this huge diversification in the suburban areas, and a lot of these suburbs were not part of desegregation plans in the 20th century because they didn't have very large percentages of Black or Latino students. Mm-hmm. So these are districts that are grappling with demographic change for the first time while trying to meet a number of different educational goals as well, and we need to support them. You know, there are places where there may not be an active NAACP group, there may not be other kind of civil rights groups or educational groups that are helping them think through the drastic change. They may not be partnering with their housing agencies to really think about how to make sure that housing and school efforts are, you know, working across purposes. So there's a lot of change that has to go on in the suburbs to respond to this, and it needs to be a cross-collaboration type of response if we're going to make it long-lasting and sustaining.
Erica Frankenberg, sounds like the conversation will continue. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Erica Frankenberg, Penn State professor and co-author of the report Brown at 60, Great Progress, A Long Retreat, and An Uncertain Future. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.